Let's get started on another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. We need to pick up the story in 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 31, more specifically the second half of verse 30, where we have a battle between Ben-Hadad and his Syrian army against the Israelis. It's the second year of fighting that's going on between these two groups. And they had thought that is, the Syrians had thought that the reason they lost the previous year is because they were fighting against the Israelis who had a god of the mountains. So they intentionally picked a fight on the plains of Megiddo, effectively, just outside the city of Aphek, on the extreme western end of this plain. And they got beat again. And so we are told that those that survived among the Syrians ran into the city, and a whole bunch more of them got killed. And then we have this about the king specifically. Ben-Hadad also fled. He entered an inner chamber in the city, so he's trying to hide out from the mop-up forces of Israel. His servants said to him, "Behold now, we've heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings." So we've heard this rumor that the Israeli royalty don't like to really kill people that have survived a battle. So let's do this. Let us put sackcloth around our waists. Sackcloth is a symbol of sorrow and remorse, repentance. And put ropes on our heads. A little bit uncertain exactly what that's about. Possibly little nooses that they put up and over their heads, down around their necks to show that they were open to being led away as slaves or something in that nature. But it says, "And then we'll go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will spare your life." So figuring that the king is the one that really needs this mercy. So they tied sackcloth around their waists, and they put ropes on their heads and went to the king of Israel and said, "Your servant Ben-Hadad says, please let me live." So an entourage under what we'd call a white flag truce goes and speaks to the king to ask for mercy for their king. They use the term, "your servant Ben-Hadad." But listen to how the king replies, and this is King Ahab. He said, "Does he still live? He's my brother." And they jump on that. Verse 33, "Now the men were watching for a sign." You know, they were kind of paying attention. They're trying to read the room. And when they said, when the king had said, "my brother," they quickly took up from him and said, "Yes, your brother Ben-Hadad. Yes, that's the one. He's looking for mercy." And so he said, "Go and bring him." And so Ben-Hadad came to him and caused him to come up into the chariot. And Ben-Hadad said to him, "The cities that your father took from my father took from your father, I will restore, and you may establish Bazar for yourself in Damascus as my father did in Samaria." And Ahab said, "I'll let you go on those terms." So he made a covenant with him and let him go. So we were talking about this kind of last time, this idea that the Syrians had been causing trouble for the Israelis. The Israelis had a chance to knock them down twice with God's help. And what happens at the end? Ahab lets the offending leader get away. Even enters into a peace agreement with him where they will have reciprocal trade agreements in their two capital cities. So that is why God sends a prophet of judgment to the king. And so we read about that next in verse 35. "A certain man of the sons of the prophets," and if I'm not mistaken, this is one of the earliest times we've seen this phrase, if not the first time, the sons of the prophets. You remember that when Israel broke away, northern Israel broke away from southern Judah, that very quickly a lot of the spiritual leaders, the legitimate spiritual leaders, talking about the priests and Levites, who were living up in the north, left and went down into Judah. And a lot of the people who were righteous residents of the northern kingdom of Israel, they abandoned their own inheritance, their own properties, and they moved south as well. And so we ended up with a big spiritual vacuum in northern Israel. It would appear that at some point, God raised up both prophets and the next generation of prophets under them, called the sons of the prophets, to help the few people that were still there, the few thousands of people that were still righteous residents in the north, to have a connection with God. And so the way we often refer to these sons of the prophets as a reference point for our mindset is these guys are part of what we call a religious school, like a Bible college. And so they are the next generation being taught by the previous generation of prophets how to interact on God's behalf. That's our best way of trying to describe this. And they are in several different cities. Now, they were almost wiped out because of Jezebel and her hatred for the true prophets of the true God. But now that we've had Elijah come into the story, and we've had the 3.5 years of the drought followed by the contest with the prophets of Baal, which the prophets of Baal lost, it seems as though these prophet schools are starting to pop back out in the open again. Okay, so with that background then, a certain man, a student, if you will, in one of these schools, a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to his fellow at the command of he who is, "Strike me, please." So he goes to somebody else that's part of the community of prophets here. And he says, "I want you to hit me as hard as you can in the face." But the man refused to strike him. Now, I think we need to take it a little bit deeper here, is that more than likely the wording by the first son of the prophets was done in the name of he who is. He who is says, "You need to hit me in the face as hard as you can and leave a bad mark." And the other guy said, "I will not obey even that command of the Lord." And so that becomes a problem. He had been given an instruction. He didn't understand this instruction, why it needed to happen. That'll come up later. But because this, again, I'm going to use kind of our analog, because this Bible college student said, "No, I'm not going to do that. I don't care if the Lord said." Well, he's in trouble. Verse 36, "Then he said to him, 'Because you have not obeyed the voice of he who is, behold, as soon as you have gone from me, a lion shall strike you down.'" Now, we already saw this on another occasion where a prophet from southern Judah came to Bethel on the day that they were dedicating that altar and worship site for the golden calf at Bethel. And he'd been given instructions, don't stay there, don't eat or drink anything there, do your message, turn around, come back. And he got lied to by somebody, and he stayed and ate and drank and broke the instructions. And what happened to him? He was attacked by a lion. So now here we have this disobedient son of the prophet, told, because of your disobedience, you too will die by lion. And the story says, as soon as he had departed from him, a lion met him and struck him down. So exactly as the word of God said through this other son of the prophet. Verse 37. So then he found another man and he said, strike me, please. Now again, we have to understand this is another son of the prophets. He was told, God wants you to hit me in the face as hard as you can. And this one went, yeah, I'll do that. And he does. The man struck him and wounded him. I mean, gave him a really bloody wound in the eye or something in the forehead. Enough that the prophet departed and waited for the king, by the way, disguising himself with a bandage over his eyes. So he's been hit hard enough. Maybe his nose got broken, you know, the cartilage. But he's wearing something over most of his eyes so that he can't easily be recognized. Because, evidently, this particular son of the prophets, maybe we should think of him as one of the teachers, one of the professors in the school, he was known to King Ahab by sight. Verse 39, as the king passed, he, meaning the prophet, cried to the king and said, your servant went out into the midst of the battle. Remember, we just had two significant battles only a few months apart in two different calendar years. And so this guy claims that he was in one of those fights, the most recent one, clearly. And behold, a soldier turned and brought a man to me and said, guard this man. If by any means he's missing, your life shall be for his life, or else you're going to pay a talent of silver. You know, 75 pounds or so of silver, roughly several years' wages would be the penalty to make up for not being executed, for letting a prisoner escape. So that's the cover story. That's the illustrative story that this prophet is giving. As your servant was busy here and there, he was gone. So as the tale is spun, it's, I lost the guy. So either I'm going to be killed or I have to pay the fine. Verse number 40 continues. The king of Israel said to him, so shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it. So it's going to happen exactly as you were told. Either you're going to be executed for letting a prisoner of war escape, or you have to pay up that multiple years worth of salary. One or the other. And that's when, verse 41, the prophet hurried to take the bandage away from his eyes. And the king of Israel recognized him as one of the prophets. So he takes the bandage away, even with the, you know, maybe the broken nose or the black eyes or, you know, the puffed up face or cut on the face. The king still recognizes him. And that's when the message gets delivered. Verse 42, he said to him, thus says he who is, because you've let go out of your hand the man whom I had devoted to destruction. So, just like the story, King Ahab had been expected by God to take custody of Ben-Hadad and execute him for crimes against Israel. So because you let go out of your hand the man whom I'm devoted to destruction, therefore your life will be for his life and your people for his people. So you're going to end up dead, and a whole bunch of your people are going to end up dead too. And we know that's going to happen within the next few years. By the way, this is all happening, I believe, in 865 B.C., And it's about the 77th year of the nation of northern Israel, and about the 20th year of King Ahab. So he's only got a couple of years left before he dies. Now on to the next story. The king of Israel went to his house vexed and sullen and came to Samaria. So he is upset that he gets this bad prophecy. He is angry. He is pouty. And he takes that attitude back to Samaria proper. And I don't think it necessarily means the capital city. I think it might mean the region where he's just finished up in the valleys or the plain up in southern Galilee. And now he's back into the Samarian region, the Samarian hills, perhaps. But eventually, this takes place. Verse 1 of chapter 21. Now Naboth the Jezreelite, now Jezreel was the name of the city in pretty much the central portion, a little bit to the east of central, of this valley that is south of Galilee, but north of the hills in which Samaria is found. We call it the Jezreel Valley. We call it the Plains of Moab. The city of Jezreel actually sits right between two watersheds. To the north, all of the water sources flow eastward into the Jordan. South of Jezreel, all the water sources flow westward into the Mediterranean. And so it is a centralized location in a wonderful growing area. And one of the things that they grow there are vines for grapes. So Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard in Jezreel, beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. So the palace, probably in the eastern end of the city of Jezreel. I've been to the ruins, or at least near the ruins, didn't go up into them. But I was on the east end, so right around where these things are taking place. After this, Ahab came to Naboth. Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden because it's near my house, and I'll give you a better vineyard for it. Or, if it seems good to you, I'll give you its value in money. So, at some point, very shortly after he got into this little pouting time, after he got chewed out by God's prophet, Ahab figures, you know what? I'd really like to have a nice vineyard and a nice kitchen garden area for my palace. And this guy owns it. It's just on the other side of the wall, and it's beautiful. It's very nice. And he contacts him and says, I'll either give you a nice place elsewhere, or I'll pay you a big bunch of money for it. Now, keep in mind that all the properties had been divided up at the beginning of Israel's history among the families. Everybody got their family inheritance. And so the reality is some of these families would sell off for a period of time their inherited property. You know, they'd lease it out for a few years. Or they might lease it out for the full number of years until the next year of Jubilee, which comes every 50 years. Now, there was a Jubilee not too long before this story. So what is being asked of this man is, give up your inheritance for the rest of your natural life. I want it to come to my family. And then eventually it'll revert back to your family, but I want it for my use. Verse 3, Naboth said to Ahab, he who is forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. So his response is, no, I'm not going to do it. It's my family farm. It's my family vineyard. It's our family inheritance from he who is. I am not going to sell you the rights to it. And once again, Ahab gets into his little pouty mode. Ahab went into his house, apparently his palace in the Jezreel Valley, and he was vexed and sullen again because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had told him or said to him. For he said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. He lay down on his bed and turned away his face and would eat no food. Now, this is shocking because this guy has got to be fairly old. He's been on the throne for 20 years. He was a full-grown adult, no doubt, probably in his 20s, at least, whenever he came to the throne. So we're talking about a guy in his 40s. He might even be in his early 50s. And he is acting like a little bitty kid, a little bitty baby. He doesn't get his way, so he goes to his bed and stares at the wall and won't eat. And so Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said, why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food? And he said to her, and you got to picture him being all pouty, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite, and I said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it please you, I'll give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. So I don't get to have what I want. And Jezebel treats him like the baby he's acting. His wife said to him, do you now govern Israel? So are you or are you not a king? Come on, you big baby. Arise, eat bread, let your heart be cheerful. I'll give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. So she is probably the power player in this power couple. She is the more active member of it. Remember, she's the one that's really been pushing the anti-Yahweh stuff. It was her pet prophets that were in the contest and lost. She was the one that told Elijah she was going to kill him. So she is a very powerful and aggressive person. So verse 8, she wrote letters in Ahab's name, so by the power of the king, sealed them with his seal. She sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. Now, he's from Jezreel, so this is to the elders of the city of Jezreel. She wrote in the letters, proclaim a fast. Now, it's not a festival. It's not a happy time. This is, most fasts are intended to be in connection with prayer, which means that something wrong's happening, something bad's happening. So proclaim a fast because there's something bad happening, and then set Naboth at the head of the people, not as an honorable thing, but as in you're going to accuse him in front of everybody at the fast. I think effectively she's saying you need to tell people there's a problem with Israel. Maybe it's related to the recent military actions, you know, why they got attacked 2 years in a row. But you declare a fast, have a little prayer time, and then bring this guy up in front of everybody. Verse 10, set two, because you need a minimum, worthless men, sons of Belial, meaning scoundrels, people who don't care. Put these two worthless men opposite him, let them bring a charge against him, saying, you've cursed God and the king. And so after you bring this charge of treason against him, you know, he's cursing against God, that's treason against God. He's cursing King Ahab, that's treason against God's man, the king. After that, take him out and stone him to death. So railroad him. Now, the leaders already know this is not true, but they go along with it, which means they're bad guys too. The men of the city, the elders and the leaders who lived in the city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, probably afraid of her. As it was written in the letters that she had sent to them, they proclaimed a fast, they set Naboth at the head of the people, and the two worthless men came in and sat opposite him. And the worthless men brought charges against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth cursed God and the king. So all of this is done according to the letter of the law. The charges are brought by two witnesses. The people hear the testimony of these two witnesses. The testimony is in agreement, even though it's a lie. And the penalty, of course, is capital. It's a capital crime to curse God and to curse the king. Not just say the words, but to take action against them. And so, even though it's a railroad job, it's a made-up thing, the community took him outside the city and they stoned him to death with stones. And so now he's dead. Verse 14, then they sent to Jezebel saying, Naboth has been stoned, he is dead. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, he's dead. Now, it is perfectly in character that Ahab doesn't even bother to ask, well, how did that happen? The only thing that he's interested in is, wow, so his property is now available for me to take. So verse 16, as soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. So now he has confiscated this property. Now, does this mean that Naboth didn't have any heirs? Or does it mean that Jezebel had in Ahab's name declared that his property was forfeit to the crown because he was a traitor, because he had taken active action, he didn't, but this is the lie, against the crown. That's probably the way it all went down. But God is not going to let it slide. So mark your place right there for verse 17, and we'll get back into the Word next time.